find out what it's like to experience the world from above. Fly your own drone today. DroneCloneExperts.com specializes in high-quality, affordable drones. Now introducing their Limitless 2 model, equipped with a 4K camera for stunning Ultra HD clarity, GPS with precision auto return, and up to 25 minutes flight time on a single charge. Visit DroneCloneExperts.com now and enter promo code RADIO to receive 15% off your entire order. That's DroneCloneExperts.com.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Mike Berlew, haven't seen you in a while. It's been a couple slow news weeks here.
I heard a possum in Mississippi gave birth to triplets.
So I figured
that'd be the big thing we'd be talking about for the next hour.
Yeah, I mean, personally for us, I mean, we recorded our last episode. We recorded a few weeks back to have a little leeway, you know, in case certain major life events happened in that time period, and you know, things happen. And then there's this whole minor thing going on in the United States right now that's happening. But other than that, I thought we'd talk about our favorite fabrics and what kind of clothing you prefer in different times of year.
Steel wool and steel wool again.
So you like to roll around in steel wool.
I like the fabric and, you know, whatever the season is. I mean, nothing like going down to the beach with my steel wool shorts and just enjoying the afternoon.
See, now I have to live with that image of you in like a steel wool, like mankini. and just as the day goes on, like, blood coming out the sides of the of your thighs and the irritation just getting worse and worse.
Yeah, I would advise when it starts itching, do not touch anything. there are backfires to it. I still maintain it's number one.
How is the steel wool bikini in the ocean waves? Is that, I imagine that's a little uncomfortable, possibly.
Kind of terrible considering it, the waves makes it rub up against you and then the sea salt gets into the wounds, but there's still just enough where I prefer it over cotton, Scott.
In your opinion, it's a small price to pay for fashion, you know? It's like,
yeah,
you gotta
absolutely. Listen, nobody else is going out there doing it. Everybody's staring at me, so I know it's a hit. So I don't feel any reason why I should change my ways.
Well, anyway, everybody, welcome to Verbal Shenanigans. Happy to be back. Really, we've kind of been off from talking to each other for about 3 weeks or so, or 2 weeks, or I'm not really exactly sure. I know we did some interviews and whatnot, but we are kind of back. So if the last thing you heard was outdated, that's probably because we haven't talked in a few weeks. But welcome to the show. I took a few weeks, about 2.5 weeks exactly, to take some time off to the birth of my first child.
Woo.
Thank you, audience. Thank you.
Encore. Woo.
Oh, thank you, Mike. Thank you. And it is, it's actually amazing I found time right now to even get on the podcast. But, you know, Mike, it turns out babies are a lot of work.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
You know, from when I seen cartoons, you get into like wacky adventures and stuff like that. But for the most part, at the end of the night, you and the wife get into bed, talk out the day, have a cute little joke, kiss each other, and then go to sleep.
Right. And then the baby just chills the whole time, right?
Yeah. Well, until next week, you know, then the hijinks continue again. So you get 6 days off.
Yeah. I thought, you know, you just put some milk in a bowl like a cat and you could leave him for a week or so and you're okay.
Yeah. You know, I've been hearing this stuff about diapers, but I heard if you roll up a newspaper and slap them, that might do the trick. If, you know, if they don't like use the toilet.
Wow. Note to self, guys. Mike doesn't have kids, so don't take anything he says. don't call the authorities after listening to this episode.
Yes, and again, steel wool diapers.
Ah.
I demand the babies have to be fashionable just like the parents.
It's exfoliating. That's what it gets rid of all the dead skin, you know?
Yeah, I mean, newborns have all that extra skin, so they got to learn how to shed it.
So I guess I'll take you through this this journey of birth, if you will. Now, I didn't birth the child, so my journey was a lot less intense, I guess, if you will. But let me tell you, the whole process is kind of as intense and extreme as people tell you, if not more. I will tell you that. So Monday, my baby's due date was the 18th, and which was a Sunday, which was your birthday. So
it should have been the prophecy.
Thankfully, but, 12 o'clock hit on Monday morning, and we were celebrating over here like, yes, I can, you know, so I didn't have to hear this for the rest of the length of this podcast and our friendship.
Well, I'm trying to look up some like pagan calendars, hoping like in essence it was like the virtual 18th, but we'll get back to you on.
So you're saying it's fraud, possibly the day it's fraud. Yeah. You need to recount the calendars, see if.
I mean, from what I got from the birth certificate, it looks Kenyan, so I'm a little suspicious.
Right,
a little suspicious. Got to be honest. You know, interviewing people who are in the hospital, a lot of people said, "Who is Scott Brennan?" Now, you may say it's because I just talked to the lunch lady, but my sources say that's a reliable source in the hospital.
So you're saying that there's a possibility that maybe we had him on the 18th and just hid the news just to deflect you winning the prophecy, is what you're saying.
Yeah, and I feel like this is one of these things, like 20 years from now, little Shay is like in the attic digging through some stuff, and he's like, what's in this box? Oh, some baby pictures, whatever. And he picks up the piece of paper and he like runs downstairs. He's like, Dad, was I born on October 18th? And you're just like, we don't talk about that. Don't you ever say that out loud again.
And like thunder claps and the clouds roll in quickly and your face appears in the mirror.
Yeah, the door just bursts wide open. You just see me standing there. I've been waiting.
You hear the chains rattling like the ghost of Christmas past coming. The prophecy. It has been told. You know?
You're like screaming and they'll put a ring of salt around the house. They'll keep them out.
Get the sage. So, morning of the 19th comes. I go off to my day job, which is not podcasting, believe it or not. We haven't gotten that wealthy yet. Go there, probably start working for about legitimately 11 minutes and see the phone vibrating on the desk. It's the wife. I'm like, oh boy, answer it. And sure enough, babe, I think my water broke. And right away, I just basically alert my coworkers and I sprint out the door. So now, in the movies, you know, you hear water broke and you think like instantly we're going into, you know, it's game time.
Yeah, it's like 10 minutes away.
Right.
Something like that.
So I'm driving pretty hastily down the highway and get there and everything's fine. And it turns out our doctor wanted us to come into the office before we went to the hospital, which I found super weird. So we go to the doctor and I'm still not allowed into the doctor's office due to the COVID, you know, stuff. So I'm like kind of panicking and she had left her phone in the car. So I didn't know what was going on. And I'm like, oh, you know, I hope everything's okay. I hope everything's all right. And we're going to the hospital. So sure enough, she comes out and they're like, oh, you're in labor. You're off to the hospital. So check into the hospital. It's pretty calm still. Nothing really happening. And hours go by. They're just basically monitoring her and, you know, checking her blood pressure and having the IV and checking how far along she is. It's
now, before you continue, I don't care. So, the hospitals allow you in for this,
The hospitals do allow us in, thank God, because at the beginning of all this, there was like a couple hospitals that weren't letting the husbands in or the fathers in, which I can't even imagine what for both parties involved in that. Like, for a woman to go alone into birth has to be absolutely frightening. You know, and then
I mean, maybe these hospitals from like the 1950s, they're like, sir, you don't come in. You go into another room, watch sports, and smoke a cigar.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what you do.
Say, good luck, honey, and go back to work. You know, see you. I'll pick you up tomorrow morning.
I think that's actually, as funny as it sounds, like the story of my birth. Like, my dad was at work. My mom had contractions. She went to the hospital. My dad left work to go down. She basically gave birth to me. He saw me. He kissed my mom, and he went back to work because there was none of this, like, you know, baby leave or anything like that. So
yeah,
it's either give up a paycheck or
yeah, different culture, you know, different time. And plus, you were like the third kid. He was probably like, yeah, whatever, you know.
I know what this is.
I've done this before. Whatever, you'll figure it out, honey. See you on the ride home. You know, here's some cab money.
We had a pickup truck. He just tossed me back there, bringing me home. It was cool.
Yeah. So yeah, they let you in. No visitors, no anything like that, but they let you in. Like I said, I couldn't imagine my wife being in birth for God knows how long, labor for how long, and like not being allowed in. Like, sitting in the parking lot in your car, that had to be like horrendous experience for whoever went through that. So we get there, and it's like hour after hour, nothing's really happened. Contractions are starting to get closer and closer. And it's getting to like nighttime now. If you remember that it was Monday, that Monday football was on. There was two football games. There was the Bills,
Bills Chiefs,
and the other game. So it was, I'm sitting there just basically like watching football, and you know, she's starting to, the contractions are starting to hurt or whatever. So we finally decide to take we weren't sure if she was going to take the epidural or not. Now, I will tell you, Mike, I don't know if you ever decide to have kids or whoever's listening has kids, take that goddamn epidural, man. It is like liquid gold. It went from like pain every couple minutes, whatever, 3-4 minutes, you know, to she was able to relax. We watched football together. She was falling asleep every once in a while. It's like unbelievable what it does. It's crazy. So that like took the pain away for like 7 more hours, which is pretty unbelievable. So
yeah, I don't ever get why, like, what is the advantage of not doing it? It seems like just bragging. It's like, you know, when I gave birth and all the doctor did was put a leather strap in my mouth and said chew on this.
Yeah,
but it was worth it. It was natural.
I don't know if it's like people want to feel the whole experience of childbirth, or people are afraid of medication and like the baby. I have no idea, but like I couldn't even imagine her going, because we didn't end up actually getting to like the pushing stage till probably about 10 o'clock at night. So that was like 12 hours or whatever it was of her just like being in pain like that. That would have been awful. So she gets in and it's like, it's pretty relaxing. And then we get to like the pushing part. And my wife's like, yeah, I got this. This is no problem. He'll be out in a half hour, you know? Well, needless to say, that didn't happen, okay?
Your wife embellished her pushing abilities, is what you're telling
right.
us.
Right. I guess she thought, you know, she was a former athlete, you know? It's no problem. Shoot him right out of there.
Like, was she, like, practicing in the gym or something? Did she was able, like, listen, I got a 20-pound barbell. Watch this. Nothing.
I don't know if she was. She didn't tell me, but I have noticed some holes in the wall. No. So the pushing starts, and an hour and a half goes by, and we're still okay. And the second hour and a half is brutal, man. Baby just didn't want to come out, and you know, he's a big boy. He was born 9 pounds 1 ounce, so he's no peanut, that's for sure. And he's got a big old head. He takes after his father. He's got like a 99th percentile head. So you can imagine why, how he you know, he didn't want to come out, that's for sure.
Like literally a bowling ball on shoulders.
Yeah, pretty much, pretty much. So, yeah, I don't want to get too deep into her part of it, but my your part as a man is very, it's very humbling. Like, and it's very, like, you feel like a useless, you feel pretty useless and awful at the same time, and it's exciting at the same time, but you're, like, you're watching the person you love just, like, in the worst amount of pain going through this, like, you know, you see it on TV, and, like, on TV or movies, right, they're, it seems like they're pushing just real hard for, like, an extreme amount of time, and they come out, but it's really, like, waves, right? You have to, like, push on the contractions for whatever it is, 30 seconds or whatever, and then it goes away for, like, 3 minutes, and then you push it on, so it's, like, this weird intensity, 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 rest, 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 rest. It's like interval training. So like
rhythmic exercising. Gotcha.
Yes. So my job was to like every time was to like grab a leg and count to 10, like three times. And then like in between, I was like the cut man in like a MMA fight, like in between and like, oh, you want water? I'm like wiping her face. I'm like feeding her ice chips. Cause she's like not allowed to have water. It's insane. I don't know, man. It felt like eternity. And you're just sitting there like, man, like all I did was provide the batter, if you will, in this experience. I'm not experiencing any of this besides like basically being the glorified hand holder. And it's very extreme experience. And like, I don't know, like the worries of like being grossed out or like not looking at things kind of completely goes away. Like you're kind of just in the moment and everything's really real. Yeah.
So how's the wife going through this? Like, is she seem to keep, obviously she's in pain, but is she like keeping an even keel? Is she like going back and forth on emotions?
Pretty consistent, but the exhaustion starts to kick in. Like it becomes, you don't have much left in the tank after a while. And that's when it becomes like really heartbreaking. Cause you're stuck in a, there's no going halfway. You know what I mean? Like it gets to a point where you have to complete the task at hand. Otherwise the baby's never coming out. And that's,
it's got an umbilical cord. So like if it falls out later, it's pretty cool. You know? Stay up there.
Yeah. So time goes by and he can't get around like the pelvic bone, but eventually they come in. And so it started off with just a nurse and us, then a nurse and like a med student came in, then our doctor came in, and then the resident doctor came in. So the group just starts to like add on and it becomes like a cheering squad. Like, come on, come on, come on. And in some ways, like, that's great. In other ways, I feel like it's even, like, more pressure on the mother. Like, you know, like, it's, like, that privacy, like, you and, like, the doctor is kind of gone. Now there's, like, a group of people watching you, like, rooting you on. And so
it's, like, a bunch of fans of the Little League game. And all there's, like, two or three going, come on, Alex. Come on, Alex. You go, yeah, I got this. When, right. Like, 20 of them, you're, like, man, I don't want to let them down.
I know. And they were doing all different positions to get him out, blah, blah, blah. We don't have to get too much into that. But so the moment comes like where that, I guess they know exactly when he's like going to be out within the next push or two or three time. Because all of a sudden it's like they start putting on their like big blue robes and cut with their hands and gloves. And it's like the lights get brighter. And all of a sudden like it went from five people and you hear just like, and like 20 people come into the room, like all these nurses come in, and sure enough he comes out. I have no, and we didn't know what it was, and she was like, how do you want to, you know, how do you guys want to find out? I'm like, I don't know, announce it, I guess. Like, I didn't want to be, because I probably would have blew it. I probably been like, it's a girl, I don't see anything, and then we'd hold it and be like, oh wait, we got this, or, you know, like I would have screwed it up.
I figure I'll take the kid home and maybe we'll, the first day we open up the diapers. Oh, man, we messed up with that name. Dang it.
So he comes out right away, like a bunch of nurses scoop him up and he goes over to like the scale and they're like, dad, come here. And you walk over and they're like cleaning him, throwing him on a scale, weighing him. They're like, do you want to take a picture? Do you want to hold him? I'm like, okay. And then my wife's getting worked on. And then, like, it's just people everywhere. It's like a, you know, it's like a pit crew. Like a NASCAR analogy. It's like they come in, it's like, doo, 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 you know, like, I mean, I didn't know why they had the guns and all, but, you know, it was.
Yeah. You panic when they yelled loose wheel.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't know why there was a Goodyear tire bouncing around the delivery room, but, you know. So then all of a sudden, like, you know, she gets to hold them or whatever, and they wrap them up. And it's so weird because you go from this intense moment with doctors all around you, and they're like, okay, we're going to leave you guys now. And it's like, boom. Like, you just gave birth, and now the baby's like yours and in the room with you, and there's no one there all of a sudden. And they're like, oh, if you want, you could put him in that bassinet right there. And we're like, okay. You know, like, it's just a really strange experience.
Questions? You just going to let us be with this? Mm-hmm. So this is ours now? Okay.
Yeah, and it totally doesn't, like, hit you at all. And then they move us into our other room, and there is no such thing as sleep at the hospital, man. It is, and the hospital is what they call, like, baby friendly. They don't really want you to send the baby to the nursery. They want the baby in the room with you, which, in hindsight, if I ever do this again, I think I'm going to tell them, like, we're going to tell them, like, take the baby for like 4 hours, because you need to sleep. Like, I don't know, to tell, like, I get the bonding time thing, but, like, to tell a mother who just did like 12, 13, 14 hours of labor, like, okay, you're in charge of this baby now, figure it out. Yeah. It's tough. You need to. And then, like, I had to sleep on, like, it was like a, you can't even call it a couch. And it was like really kind of like slippery pleather. And I brought like a sleeping bag that was also kind of that like slippery material. So I'd like lie in it and just slowly be like, and like sliding off. So any, like, moment of sleep I'd have, I'd slide, and I'd get that, like, gravity, like, falling feeling, and wake up for another, like, and then every 2 minutes, it seems like every half hour, a nurse is popping in. Oh, we're here to check the weight. Oh, we're here to check on you. Oh, we're here to check. Oh, here's room service. Here's cleaning. So it's like, we were only there for 2 days, but you probably get, like, a half hour of sleep, something like that. And
you couldn't whisper in your wife's ear, hey, baby, can you move over for a little bit? I need a little shut-eye. It's been a long night, babe.
Let me in that bed. Yours reclines.
Hey, don't be complaining. I was the one to get you ice chips, okay?
And, like, so, like, we could have stayed one more night, but we could tell we were starting to get, like, the boot, especially with, like, the COVID stuff. They don't want you there that long. And the walls start closing in after a while, man. I don't know, like, even when you go visit someone at a hospital, it's like, you can't wait to get out of there. There's just, I don't know, there's something prison-like, you know, about it. And it's a little different because you're learning everything about the baby, but you're just exhausted. And then after a while, you start thinking, like, all I want to do is just sit on my couch, you know, and just put the TV on and have no other noise going. I don't know. So we left, and you get home, and it's just this weird, okay, now what? You know, like, now what do we do? Like, we're in charge of that thing, you know, like, and you try, like, everything they tell you, and the first night, all of a sudden, he's just screaming. We feed him, like, the amount they tell you, and we're like, what's wrong with him? Something must be wrong. And then eventually we're like, well, let's try feeding him again. And we feed him, and he just, like, calms down and goes to bed. We're like, damn, like, all it was food. And he's like, there's the amount they told us. He ate like five times the amount they told us. Like, he, you know, like, I don't know if it's because he's just big or he just feeds at night. And it's just like the first couple of days, he was an angel, slept on his little boppy pillow thing. He was fine. But then this weekend came and he really showed us how a little 9-pound thing can keep you, can really just, wreck the whole house life for a little while, and kind of, I mean, wreck in the best way it's possible, but really disrupt the whole, any yin and yang you have or anything you're used to. You're used to getting up at this time. Not anymore. It's just, you see all hours of the day and you're like, oh, he's got to feed in 3 hours. I got a couple hours, but it takes like a half hour to feed him. And then by the time you change him and then you make you're like, oh crap. It's like, it's time to feed again. And then, like, this kid just sucks down formula like a, like a gas tank. Like there's times at night where we're like, I guess we got to make another bottle after he ate a whole bottle. It's just insane, man. Insane.
The baby already up to like 25 pounds now.
He gained, we went to the doctor's, he gained like another 12 ounces already, which is a lot, you know, like if you think
is
about
that good.
Or? Yeah. I mean, they say gaining weight is good. I don't know. He's a beast though, man. He like raises his head already. When he kicks, he can like, he hurts. Like he can get a shot at you, man.
Listen, when you give him an Irish name, you got to expect that there's going to be some ruckusness to it.
Yeah. Like, he's his father's
child. Like, there's no such thing as the quiet Shea, all right?
I don't know. I remember Shea Stadium many years when the Mets were terrible. There was some quiet Shea moments there.
Yeah, but that still involves drunkenness and throwing things in the field. So there's no pure quiet involved with Shea.
That's true. Did I ever tell you that I went to the last game at Shea Stadium, and they did the last, you know, the closing ceremony. They had to win that game to get in the playoffs, and they did the closing ceremony after the game, after they lost.
Yeah, you brought that up. That was the year, I think that was the year you guys had like a 4-game lead on us with like 7 games to go, and you found a way to let it slip away. I think that was was it 2007, I want to say.
Yeah.
2006 or 2000. Yeah, 2007, because that was the year we went against the Rockies and got swept, and then we got the World Series the next year. Yeah,
but there were 2 years in a row the Mets brutally blew it. The last one was at Shea. And anyway, it was just like, yeah, instead of doing the ceremony before the game and hyping the fans up and getting the place like rocking, they do it after, and everyone's like sad. And but... Oh, and to clear that up, people have asked me, like, oh, you know, did you name your kid Shea after the Mets? And the honest answer is no. Like, I don't know, the name popped up. I think I was watching, like, hockey or something, and I think, like, Shea Weber was the player. And I'm like, you know, I really like that name, and I like the spelling of it. And then I guess, like, it's like bonus points that it kind of ties into the Mets. I would never really name him, like, after just, like, a sport. Like, I don't know.
How many jokes about the next kid being Citibank?
I got a couple of them. I got a couple of texts like, hey, you should have named them City Field or something like that. I'm like, thanks, guys.
Yeah. I'm like, all right, that since you're still a comedian, I'm like, there's going to be like 20 people sending you that. I'm like, I'm going to hold off on that. We'll have the conversation on the podcast. And
yeah.
Out of curiosity, what was the name if it was going to be a girl?
I think we're still going to hold on to that one. I think we're going to still keep that in the pocket in case it happens again. And, I don't know. We like to the whole hiding thing. Some, you know, both the gender and the name, the surprise element did make it
a birth date, obviously.
yes. It's the fake birth date. I think we're going to hold on to that one. But
interesting.
It was David. Right. It was David Wright. I'm sorry. You know, like
David.
You know, if we do have another kid, you know, maybe it will be a girl, and you know, then we'll have to reveal then.
What's the girl's name? Giant Stadium.
Rodney Hampton Brennan. So, I don't want to like go, you know. It's kind of like, you know, trite or oversaid. It is really like an unbelievable experience. I still drive to work or the store and sometimes like question, like, am I really a father? Like, am I really responsible for a kid? And it is a truly amazing experience so far. Like, I can't wait till he's able to like play a little bit. Cause right now it's kind of like, he loves mommy. Like, he likes daddy sometimes, but he loves mommy, you know? And then I feel bad when I can't get him to calm down. And then I give him to her and he calms down.
That's good. That means more time to podcast.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Let me tell you, my wife loves that I'm up here in the office right now, podcasting at the moment, you know? She's so happy.
Just like yell downstairs, honey, Berlo has a funny anecdote about dog.
Yeah. Put it this way. I got the don't be up there for 3 hours.
Speech.
Okay. Yeah. I'm like, don't worry.
Speaking of dogs, how's Obi feeling about the new one?
So we were a little worried about the dog. Like, he's pretty, what's the word, curious when like new things come in, and like, my nieces and nephews have come in. He gets a little crazy. And but first night I brought him back. Our friend had him, so we brought the baby back. And then I went and picked up OB after like an hour or two and brought him. And you could tell he comes in. We put the baby's blanket in his bed and stuff. He comes in, and he has like that look like someone's been here. And he's smelling around. And he settles down, and we're like, oh, that wasn't bad, you know? And all of a sudden, the baby makes a noise, like, meh. And he shoots up, and he's like, what the hell? Like, and what? He starts going crazy. And I think he didn't know the actual baby was there. Like, he thought maybe someone was there when he wasn't. But he was like, oh, my God, there's someone here. And but I got to give him credit. He's been pretty damn good with the baby. Like, we let him sniff him, but we try to, like, stop it there. Like, no licking, no anything like that. And he's been good.
Yeah.
He's definitely playing second tier a little bit, which I think, Bob, you know, he's gone down the one rung, if you get, in a way.
Yeah, he's down a tier. He's in B tier right now. Yeah. It's like, he's the free version of HBO Max. It used to be the pay service.
Right.
But now it's like, you know what? Nobody's asking for this, so we'll give it away.
Yeah. So it is truly amazing. I know everyone says that, but it is unbelievable. And I'm sure there's many more sleepless nights to come and many more days where I tell you, Mike, I just can't do it tonight because this baby's driving me nuts. But overall, it's great. And before we get to our guest, I want to tell a quick story about the baby, and I'll wrap up baby talk 2020 for now. So the other night, oh yeah, and I did cut the umbilical cord. People asked me what that was like. Honestly, it was like, they're like, do you want to cut it? I'm like, okay. And they like hold it for you and you cut it. And then they're like, 2 seconds later, they're like, do you want to trim it? I'm like, no, you guys are the professionals. You trim it. Because if I trim it, the kid's going to have like a 12-inch umbilical cord that gets stuck in his onesie. And, you know,
So how'd you get the nickname Nine Toe Shay?
Yeah.
I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
Thanks, Dad.
Yeah, I was like, you guys trim it because it'll be 3 feet long if I do it. So his umbilical cord the other night, you know, it gets all crusty and it falls off eventually. We noticed it was off. We're changing him. We can't find it anywhere. We're like, oh, maybe it's in the bed. Maybe it's in his onesie. You know, like maybe it's somewhere. Can't find it. I'm like, oh, I hope the dog didn't eat it or something like that. And I go to take a shower. I take my shirt off and I look in the mirror and I'm like, oh, I got some serious belly button lint. I go in my belly button and his umbilical cord is in my belly button. It was like he was like uploading data into me or you know.
This is the USB port. I remember I got food from here earlier.
It is so weird, man. But all is good on that front, and we're getting used to this parent life, and yeah.
Now, did you keep the placenta, as some parents do?
No, I don't know where his placenta is. It could be served in the cafeteria the next day. I would have no idea. That thing is long gone somewhere.
In all seriousness, you know, some people eat it.
Oh yeah, yeah. Some people put it in pills, like, and they'll take the pill. That's just
what?
That's just, we just don't need it. We just don't need it, man.
I don't want to find out what that's like. Is there nutrients in there? Is it
apparently
like a delicacy? Can I make a flan with it? I don't know.
Apparently, like mega nutrients. But I'll take my multivitamin. That's fine. You know, like I didn't need poor Shay's placenta. That was his home. I don't need to invade it. But yeah. But I think it is a perfect time to kind of move on to a really cool guest we have today. You think of the top, if you were to say the top five bands of all time, what kind of names come to your head?
Rolling Stones,
yep.
Queen.
Yep.
Beatles.
Yeah.
In Black Sabbath. Maybe.
Yeah, stuff like that. Right. And I would say we have a member of, you could argue, top five, top 10, whatever. When you get to those kind of numbers, you're talking just massive. And that is a little known band called Pink Floyd.
yeah, Floyd Maxingware, him in his pink outfit, goes out there with his ukulele and he sings his favorite Amish songs. I can't wait till he comes back to tour.
No. So we have Scott Page coming on the show, who is the saxophone player for Pink Floyd. He's also been part of Supertramp. He's been part of Toto and a bunch of really amazing, huge bands. And he's such an interesting dude. Whether it's his time, how he got into the Pink Floyd, whether it's the technology stuff he is involved in today. And we really enjoyed our interview with Scott Page. So without further ado, here is our interview with Scott Page. Hey,
yo.
I like the intro. I like it.
What? How you doing, buddy? Yes.
Good.
Doing well.
I'm actually sitting in a cigar room at an event that I'm at right now.
Okay.
I thought I was going to be home, but I'm good. I'm here. And you can see I'm actually sitting here with, you know who that person is, right?
I can't see. There
you go.
Who's that? Tina Turner?
Tina Turner.
Yes. All right.
I'm not sure who that is behind me there. But anyway, we're there. How are we, guys? There you go. I don't know. Who is that? Anybody know?
It looks like an old school actress of some sorts. Like I don't know.
It is an old school actress. I don't know who it is. Does it say? No, I'm just in this room. How are we, guys?
Great, man. Scott, welcome to the show. I'm Scott, and that's Mike there.
Mike Scott.
Pleasure to have you on, man. Where are you at right now? I know you're in a cigar room, but what state?
I'm in Beverly Hills. I had a meet. I didn't realize I spaced, and I had this meeting. It was on my books at 4 o'clock. We're getting ready to do this show, and so I'm interviewing a girl that is she does wine tastings. So she had a wine tasting. So we're over here kind of interviewing her right now, and I'm actually drinking wine at the same time.
Well, cheers.
And boy, is this stuff good. So anyway, do you want my camera this way or do you want it this way?
That looks good. That looks good.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
I mean, the audio is the main thing, so
How's the audio, okay?
Sounds great, actually.
Yeah. You're doing great.
Yep. Okay, beautiful.
So I guess...
Beautiful. So, all right. Well, we're going to get rocking here, and what are we talking about today?
Well, we're going to talk about whatever comes to us. But Scott, right, I guess where to start is like, you know, you're getting to a point where you've had generations after generations after generations of playing with, you know, some of the biggest bands in the world, like this small one called Pink Floyd. You know, I heard of them once or twice. But when you look at music now, like you've been doing it for so long. Has your perspective changed so much over the years? Like, do you approach music differently than you did when, like, say you were in your 20s, just trying to get your first big opportunities, or is music, you know, or do you still have have you kept the same approach your whole life?
Well, you know, that's actually a really interesting question. I've never had anybody ask that question. I think I approach music now from two points of view. Where when I was younger, I was just playing music. And now I believe that the art of music and the art of business work together.
Right.
So I have been really more, I kind of like think about music now in a sense that I try to figure out if there's a business model. I've been a tech guy, a business, you know, I'm on my fourth startup. I love business. I love the art of business and I love the art of music. And so I'm really combining it. So I try to approach it a little differently. Like I have a business aspect to it as opposed to just the music part of it, because I believe the art of music in business, because if I can make great stuff, but if nobody sees it, nobody buys it, I can't build a revenue stream,
right?
Whatever, that's fine. That's like, but that's more of a hobby. So I take a more of a business approach. What I would say that the way I approach being in the studio making a record has still been pretty much the same, even though there's so much change in technology. I really believe, you know, capturing a moment is critical. I believe today, making music, we are victims of overchoice when we go in the studio because we have tools now that can fix the pitch, can fix the groove, can fix everything. You know, hey, you're a little flat, no problem. I'll just tighten up that note. Yep. You know, so it's completely changed because when we were making records back in the day, there was that, you know, we'd get in the studio, we'd be all there at the same time. We'd say, let's cut a track. You know, five of us, we take some deep breaths and we count the bad boy off and we go and we make it happen and we do a handful of takes to try to find one where the spirit, you know, basically I would say God's jumped down on us and said, hey, this was a good take, and we make a record and kind of live with it. Now, like I said, we become that victims of overchoice where we fix everything. So my approach is really, I care about one thing when I make a record. It's not about the technology. It's not about, you know, how many notes you play, what it is. It's really about, is it feel honest? You know, an honest record. Like, and again, you look at all the Pink Floyd records and Stones and Beatles. In those days, you had to commit early in the process. Now we don't have to commit. We can throw anything down and then come back and tweak it, fix it, make it every. But in those days, we had to kind of commit on what we felt was right at the time. And we would make it happen. And I think that has to do with the little mistakes that were left end up becoming such a big part of the personality. Because on those old records, you actually could feel people kind of thinking, you know, as they played stuff, or not thinking in a sense. It was totally different. So I would say, you know, I still approach records from that point of view, really about how to capture a moment, because that moment will transcend the time. But, you know, I definitely think more about now from a business point of view, as I'm going to make a record, how is this going to be a record that will, you know, also have, it will move my business forward at the same time.
Makes sense. Right. Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah.
Now, when Scott said that question, he was talking about you in your 20s, but you've been in music even way earlier than that, back to when you were a child on the Lawrence Welk show with your father. Has it always been like an enjoyment / hobby for you, music, going on through life? Was there ever a moment where you're almost like, this is going to be a pain, it's almost like a job or a chore, where you almost thought about, maybe I'm going to go in a different direction of music?
Well, I started out, music, I wasn't really into music. I did it because my dad was a musician. Like I said, I grew up on the Lawrence Welk show, 15 years he was in that band. So my whole childhood was around early television. But I actually studied to be an architect. I studied drafting and design and stuff. And all the way through high school, I took up music. The only reason I played music at the time was kind of for my dad, because my dad was always, bless you, my dad was, you know, always told me, he says, look, you can go play some music on the weekends. You know, you don't have to work in a gas station. You can kind of get a gig and do it. And it's more fun. It's good for the soul. And so I didn't really take up music seriously until I got into high school, where I was a trumpet player at the time. And I got in a band with these guys, Jeff Beccaro and David Page, who had started a band later on, everybody knows, from Toto, right? That became Toto. So Jeff and David were I got in this band. I was the worst guy in the band. I played second trumpet. It was like a Blood, Sweat, and Tears Chicago. That was that period of time when those bands were happening. So it was a horn band. And we'd be playing gigs. And all of a sudden, I started to realize, wait a minute, we're winning all these Battle of the Bands, and there's a ton of girls in the front row.
Yeah.
And I'm like I'm sitting here working at a company called Audiodyne, drawing exploded views of parts and things. And those were the days when you used a pencil and a pen, and, you know, rulers, no computers. And I went, you know what? I'm drinking 10 cups of coffee here. I'm doing that. I like this better where girls are. So I decided to flip my entire thinking around and became a musician. But I was so bad at the time, as I was going into college, I couldn't really play well enough and I needed to study. So I started studying, you know, like basically 24/7 really studying, but I realized I had to make a living and at least pay the rent and all those things. And so I took up music copying, and I was a music copyist for a variety of different composers. One was H.B. Barnum, a very famous orchestrator, composer, arranger. And those are the days, like what he would do is he'd call me up, it'd be 2 in the morning, I just finished this score, hey, can you, I need parts. So he'd send me the score, or I'd go pick up the score. I'd come back. I'd stay up all night, and I would copy the first trumpet part, the second trumpet part, all using my hand, because I had good drafting skills. So I had a night, my copying skills look good. So I did that to support myself for a while, was to just basically keep a living while I was trying to play. But yeah, I music was something I took on later on in my life, where I really decided that I wanted to be a musician.
I mean, so you were at Supertramp for quite a while, with Toto for quite a while, Pink Floyd, like, and we'll get to that in a second. But when you enter these bands, are you there from, like, are you, for any of them, were you big fans of them before you joined? Like, was there a fear of it, or were you just like, yeah, you found it, you know, somehow organically?
Well, it's a funny story. Pink Floyd is interesting, because what happened was we were doing a record with Supertramp. So we were recording, and Dave Gilmore came to put a solo on the record. And that's where I met him that night, that day in the studio, and we hung out. And that night I happened to have a club gig down the street from Rick Davies' house, who's the keyboard player at Supertramp. And I said, hey, Dave, everybody, after the session, we're playing down the street. It was me and Jeff Baxter from the Doobie Brothers and Leland Sklar, a whole bunch of great players. We're playing in this club down the street. Why don't you come over? So Dave and everybody came over, and we hung out that night. A week later, I had this event that I was putting on. I've been really, big part of my life has really kind of been on the inventing and new innovations and technologies and stuff. And we could talk about that. But at that time, I was working on a thing called visual sound, where I was using, the idea was, it came from the fact that I was in the studio. When I'd play on the bandstand, it always was such an incredible thing to like stand next to somebody like Dave Gilmore, and what it sounded like, those sound pressure levels. It was just different standing next to him, as opposed to what you would hear on a record, because it's kind of mixed in. So I created this whole idea of zooming microphones and things, so that you could, like, when the camera would zoom in, I would have everybody wear this lavalier mic, and it would pick up that actual presence of standing there. So I was putting on this show where I was doing this, and I invited Dave, and then to come the next week when I was doing this thing where I took over Guitar Center in Hollywood. We built stages in there, and I actually had a 50-piece band made up of the Supertramp guys, the Toto guys. We had the Tower of Power horns. It was just an incredible kind of group of people together to shoot this video in this new format that I was developing at the time. And so I invited Dave. Well, it just happened to be that week, Jeff Beccaro, the drummer, you know, world famous from Toto, was playing on that Pink Floyd record, and he was with Dave that, and he said, and Jeff was playing on my thing that day. So he said, hey, Dave, I got to split. I got to get to Scott's thing. You want to come? Oh yeah. Scott told me to come. So they came, hung out. So Gilmore, I kind of hung out with Gilmore that night and stuff. And then the next other day, I got called. He called me up and said, hey, will you come put a solo on the Pink Floyd record? And I said, well, sure, I'll come in. But here's the funny part. I knew nothing about Pink Floyd.
Absolutely zero.
Other than Dave Gilmore, the guitar player from Pink Floyd, came to play on the Supertramp record we were making. So I figured, you know, okay, Pink Floyd, I heard the name, but I knew nothing about Pink Floyd, because I was more coming out of a school of, you know, Junior Walker and, you know, Stevie Wonder. I was more of an R&B kind of funk rock kind of, that was my school. So I never really paid much attention to the Pink Floyd style of music. It just wasn't, never really connected with me. So I went and I played, I went and did that. So I put the solo on the record that day. I played on the album and all that. And I still didn't realize, because when I went in there, it was really funny. I had just finished David Sanborn, I'm not sure if you're familiar, is one of the great saxophone players of all the very unique sound. He basically revolutionized kind of modern saxophone from my point of view, from the sound and all of that. So he was really hot at the time. And I was always going into records. I'd go do sessions and people would say, hey, can you sound like David Sanborn? And I would try and try. And finally I sounded so goofy. I came home and I remember I said, I'm never going to try. If somebody says play like Sanborn, never again. I'm not going to do it. So I was a little cocky. So I went into the Pink Floyd record saying, I'm playing me. If they want me, I'm playing Scott Page. That's it. So I went into that session a little bit cocky, because again, I knew nothing about Pink Floyd. I was going to go do a record date. Something I do all the time.
Yeah, sounds like it's better off, you know, that you didn't know anything. Yeah.
Yeah, so I didn't know anything. So I went in there, and I remember I was like, you know, okay, what? So anyway, I could get into the whole story of the session, but that's a whole other thing. But anyway, I put the solo on the record, and I came back. And then about 3 or 4 days later, the phone rings. I pick it up, and it's Dave Gilmour. And I didn't realize he's an English guy. I pick up the phone. It's like, Dave, oh, Scott, blah, blah, blah. Loved your solo. It's awesome. Hey, we're getting ready to go out again. Would you join the band? And I said, you know, Dave, let me think about it. Because I was like, just finished shooting that event that he had came at.
Yeah.
And so, and again, I knew nothing about Pink Floyd. I didn't really know how, you know, what that meant really at the time. So I remember calling a bunch of my friends. I said, look at this guy, this English dude, David Gilmour, calls me up on the telephone. And I just played on this Pink Floyd record, right? And they said, hey, they wanted me to join the band. And now Dave was saying it was 2 years. We were going on a tour for 2 years. So it was a long.
Wow.
It wasn't like, you know, you're going to get up and leave for 2 years. So
yeah.
I called on my friends and I said, hey, I got this call to go play. And they're like, are you crazy, dude? You got to do that Pink Floyd record. I said, what? Are you kidding me? What is it? So I remember going that night. It was about 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning. I went to Tower Records, and that's when they were open 24/7. And I went and bought a couple of Pink Floyd albums, came home and listened to them because I needed to know what it was about. Wow. Right. So I listened to him that night and went, okay, that's interesting. You know, I listened to this stuff and I went, okay, it's kind of this spacey kind of stuff, but really still didn't get it. But then everybody was saying, Paige, you got to do this gig. So I called back Dave. I said, okay, I'll do the gig. And that's how that happened. Jeez. And from that, I am so thankful. Yeah. I'm the only person in the world that my friends talked me into this, and I ended up doing the gig.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Awesome.
Yeah. And these are before the days of Google. So you probably would have got a faster answer back then. But
I know that was way before that. Right.
Yeah. Now, when you do these, I mean, iconic bands and all, is it more fun doing it in these big styles, or do you almost like yearn for your other kind of band days, bands like Geronimo Black or Alpha Band or Hang Dynasty, which is like more to your heart?
Well, you know, it's really about, for me, it's like, it's funny. People talk about these, you know, we get out and we play Floyd. You got 100,000 people out there, 80,000, 100,000. You know, when we played Venice, hundreds of thousands showed up, right? Amazing. And that's very exciting to stand there and look out there. But to be truthful, it's kind of like you're playing to a piece of wallpaper, because when you stand on those stages, they're so big and we're so spread apart that what I would need to do is I would try to find somebody in the first couple rows to play to, because there's something about being in a close environment with a bunch of people and you're playing. So there's like something about those clubs. Actually, the funny part about Floyd is I'm not downplaying. It was always awesome to play in front of, you know, tens of thousands of people. And it's an amazing experience, but there was nothing like playing in a club. And we used to play, we called the Pink Floyd band the Fishermans with a Z on the end. And we used to play clubs after we would play a big stadium.
Really?
So nobody would know. They'd say, the Fishermans are playing tonight. And we'd show up in a club.
Oh, that is
and
awesome.
Pink Floyd. And we'd all play, R&B and rock and roll tunes. We'd play no Pink Floyd songs. We'd play all the stuff. And those were really fun because it would leak out that Floyd was going to be in this club, like this tiny club that the promoter would set up for our hang to go party afterwards. After we did the show, we want to go play and have a good time. And we'd go in there and the place would be jammed to the rafters. People would be all over.
Yes.
Those were fun gigs, man. Those were special because you feel that energy and I got somebody 2-5 feet from me, 3 feet from me. I'm playing right in some chick in the front row. I'm like honking her with my saxophone.
Yeah.
It was the greatest, right? Yeah. So yeah, there's something about those type of environments.
That, I mean, I do comedy and I totally feel that, because we've done these, especially now during the pandemic, we've done these outdoor shows that, yeah, they're fun because they're able to keep comedy alive and some kind of live performing, but it's something about that sound traveling into the ethos and, you know, comedy, you need that small, intimate people like on top of you next to. So I get it. I mean, for you, it's probably 10 times better with a full band like that behind you.
Well, you know, it's actually very interesting. It's like my company, Think Experience, which is an immersive entertainment company. We're really what you're bringing up is something that's very interesting, because without that feedback, you feel it doesn't quite connect. It messes with your head as a musician, as a comedian, you want to do it. So we've been experimenting. We just did, we're actually getting ready to launch Livn.live, LIVN.live, which is it's a new form of kind of marrying live entertainment, virtual together, but thinking about virtual, because the real time, it's two-way. The opportunity of two-way streaming is what changes everything, but we're also incorporating a delivery service, right? So I can now create something in your home that gets a box, shows up, you show up at 7 o'clock, we open the box, we play, we jam, we have stuff. So we try to create an experience. And we just did a test run just recently where I went in, and what I did was we put 18 80-inch video monitors around the band, and we brought the whole audience in. And it was actually fascinating, because it was like everybody was in the front row. Huh. Because, you know, usually when you're on a stage, you look down and you see, you see the first few rows, and then the faces kind of blend. And as it goes back, it just looks like wallpaper. This was interesting because we had 300 people staring at us like 5 feet away.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So it was actually very rewarding, and it was very interesting. So I believe that the next wave is really this combination of mashing live people in the room, being able. So let's say the place can only have 50 people because of the situation. Well, those 50 people can bring in five of their friends virtually. When they come into the room, they get shown up on the screen. They're all part of the event. So actually, my friends are there with me virtually. I can see them. I can communicate them because I can connect with them and talk to them and stuff. So they're actually there. So I believe that this new model of kind of hybrid live, two-way, and delivery service is really the next thing. And it's actually pretty interesting, because I think that, you know, I think this whole COVID thing and this lockdown has forced us in technology, being a technologist, where we were going to be 5 years from now, we're there now. We just accelerated the whole, it's like crazy, because look, we're doing all these shows like now together. We're on Zooms. I catch myself, I might go out and be watering my backyard. I got four of my friends on FaceTime and we're hanging out, right? One of them's cooking, we're not staring at them, we're talking, but I can look down and actually feel their presence. They're actually there. I can show them something. So that starts, that behavior, I think, is not going to go away. And I even think when we get back to the point where even if we can sell out Taylor Swift goes and sells out a stadium, there's still going to be that virtual ticket where they can be brought backstage, be part of the event. They can come in with their friends. They can be part of the experience with their friends and be part of the whole thing. So I think this is one of the most exciting entrepreneurial times I've ever seen in my life. I mean, in all my life, I've been, I grew up in an entrepreneur. My family, my father, we had boat businesses, we had lighting businesses, we had 26 donut shops at one time, we had candy business. I mean, we had all kinds of stuff. So I grew up in a family that was constantly, my dad was a serial entrepreneur, always trying to make things happen. So I grew up around that. And now this right now, it's crazy. The opportunity, and that, because the problems that need to be solved, the new experiences that are coming out of this, and the acceleration in technology, and really this ability to have two-way communications. And once you start adding 5G into this mix, the game is over. So I think we're at a major turning point that the user experience for live events, virtual events, and all of that is kind of mashing together.
Cool. Yeah,
definitely. I mean, it's kind of funny, like, I always hear these stories of somebody saying, I used to be into music and then I changed my career and went to entrepreneurship. Generally, that's the guy who was like in a band at 19 years old and just played in his garage. He didn't get the experience of playing with Toto and Pink Floyd and so forth. Was it more of a, you were looking for the next challenge? Were you done with music when you started like building these businesses like Walt Tucker Productions and Seventh Level, or was it just, what? This excites me.
I liked business. I just liked the art of business. I just thought that was fascinating because, you know, when you make a record or you do something and you actually sell it and you get reward back because people paid for it, there's something very interesting about that. But you know, for me, it's been a combination. You know, one of my most proud things that I've ever been involved with is I saw technology coming around, and I actually developed and produced and directed the world's first interactive cartoon. Really? And it was called Toonland, starred Howie Mandel. We actually sold 11 million units of that CD-ROM. It was an educational title for kids 5 to 7 years old, 8 years old. It was funny. We were actually up for the first, what they called the Cyber Academy Awards. And it was myself, Peter Gabriel, and Todd Rundgren were up. And here I'm up against Peter Gabriel and Todd Rundgren with a children's titles doing songs of, you know, Mary Had a Little Lamb and all this stuff, but we did it really cool and very unique. But, you know, for me, it's been just this exciting ride of marrying technology and entertainment. So I saw that the opportunity that was coming along, I actually worked with a gentleman by the name of Ken Rose, and we did a product called, called Music Bites. And it was a very early CD-ROM. And what it was music for the computer program. So let's say you were running back. This is back in the day when we were running, you know, Windows machines, 386, 25 megahertz machines, very early days. And PowerPoint just came up, but they had no music or any way to run files. So we created audio for that. And that basically was my really foray into this space. Myself and Jeff Baxter from the Doobie Brothers, we actually created, we worked on it, built the music for this Prosona, this Music Bites thing. And that basically changed my life. We were promoting this music catalog for presentations at Comdex, which at the time was the largest trade show for technology trade show in the world. It later became CES, which, you know, is a massive show that goes on in Vegas. So we were there, and I remember sitting back, and I was sitting there, me and Baxter were playing in the booth, showing this music and how you used it with the computers, and we were demoing it and stuff. And I looked across the room, and I saw this thing moving on the screen. So on the break, when we finished up, I walked over and I looked at it, and it was a title called Just Grandma and Me. And it was an educational title, which is where the first time you clicked on something, I saw the first time you clicked on something and something moved. Mm. And I went, holy crap, this is the future. Yeah. Right there. This is the game right now. And I'm sitting, you know, 15 inches from the computer screen, stereo speakers. It was the ultimate experience. So I completely changed my whole thing and said, this is where I'm going. And the next thing I know, I'm hanging out with Timothy Leary with a bunch of cyberpunks in their garages creating programs back in the day. So it was a very interesting time for sure.
Well, let me ask you, you're a massively successful musician, but also, you know, it sounds like a tech nerd, if you will, in the best possible way. When you go to do a music project and you're dealing with like older musicians who are kind of been doing this for a million years, do you have to separate your musician side and tech? Because you can see the passion coming through just talking to you of your you know, your love for tech and doing these different things. But, you know, some guys just love the old school music gigs and just playing. Like, do you have to separate those two minds, the parts of your brain, or they're like, all right, Scott, calm down. We don't need a,
well, you know, it's actually interesting is because so many of my friends now are reaching out to me and go like, well, what's next, dude? Like, no more touring. I can't sell any records because there's no place to sell any music. I mean, remember, you can't sell music anymore. Music's over.
Yep.
You cannot sell music. So the question is, what can you sell? Well, the things that you can sell is you can sell the relationship. If your people will pay for that relationship, if you have something of value, they'll pay for that. They'll pay for lifestyle, which is part of that. So if there's lifestyle that ties to your relationship. And the third thing is an experience. That's why I started Think Experience is an immersive entertainment company, because I believe you can't sell all those at the prime, but what you can sell is an experience. So it's interesting. Now, all my friends they want to know, like, what do I do next? Right. What am I going to do? My entire business is completely changed. And I'm saying, dude, this is the greatest time in history for the independent artist. Greatest time, because it's all based on the fact this phone that I'm talking on is a worldwide broadcaster. Three major developments have happened. Bandwidth, storage, and horsepower have all changed. This phone in my hand, when we were back doing on 386 25 megahertz, it's not even close to the horsepower I have in this device in my hand. I have a worldwide broadcast network. I have, you know, Twitter, social networks. It's a 24-hour cocktail party. I can own the audience. All I need to do is find the audience. I can bring them. And the real important is I can take the order. I don't need anybody. I can put a freaking, you could give me a PayPal or a check, or, I mean, you can credit card me. I can actually make the money. So with that capability, it completely flat changes the game. We're moving into a direct-to-consumer business. And Kevin Kelly years ago from Wired Magazine coined this term, 1,000 true fans. A true fan is somebody that will spend $100 a year on you. Huh. So if I have 1,000 people that will spend $100, there's $100,000 in revenue, which is incredible for an independent artist. So it's not about going big. It's about going small. It's about identifying those super fans, creating value for a small number of people. So I tell artists, you got a global audience on this thing. Stop trying to boil the ocean. Go small. Find that those group of people. Build a repeatable model around how do I satisfy what those people are. And I'm golden, dude, because 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, I mean, 5,000 people, you're making $500,000 a year. That's better than most artists made for a zillion times.
It's great.
5,000 people. I'm not talking about 50,000 or 100,000. And remember, the big driver that's changed everything for the artist is data. We have access to the data now. We never had access to the data. We didn't own the emails. We didn't know user behaviors. We had no way to growth hack. We had no way to find these. This has completely revolutionized what it is. So the most important for artists is they've got to get educated. I actually teach a thing called SPACE, which is story, plan, army, conversion, education. And that is the formula for artists today to build a business. And I tell artists, we're moving into, the world is changing in this way. It's all, remember all the big social networks, well, now we're moving into hives. If you want to survive, you have to build a hive. And what I mean by that is, why did Facebook start groups and messages? Because people now are congregating around what they care about and the people they care about. But again, that 1,000 true fan model is incredible, because now it's about super fans. If I can find the super fans, and I can now with the data and using growth hackers and data scientists, I can go find exactly who I need to put my message in front of and be able to have a much better chance of basically converting them into selling things and doing things, right? Yeah. So it's really about this, the new models that are happening. So artists need to get educated and start to learn what's happening. And the beautiful part is you got Google. All you got to do is type into Google and you can find anything. You can find out how to use Twitter for business, type that into Google. How to use Facebook for business. It's either a business or it's a hobby. I tell artists, if it's a business, you have to make money with it. If it's a hobby, you're making music, you're having fun. Fantastic. I have nothing against hobbies. But if it's an artist, you have to start thinking like a businessman. You got to start thinking like an entrepreneur. And everything is out there now. It's all right there in front of your face, but you have to have the drive to want to go do it. And unfortunately, many artists that I know, they want to sit around, smoke fatties and write songs and wait for the big success. And that's fine, but it's a little bit tough right now. I mean, yeah. You want to build your audience and grow your business, and it only needs a couple thousand people. I actually have an artist friend of mine, and she says basically 125 of her fans cover her entire nut for the year.
Wow.
Because they're such super fans. They buy her stuff. She started a little clothing line. She does her stuff. She does her gigs. They show up at her gigs. They pay for all their stuff. It's 125 people. It's not 10,000 people.
Man, it's a great perspective. It really is. It's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. I see here Buzz Magazine called you one of the 100 coolest people in Los Angeles. Now, wow. I don't need help, but I'm going to give you over to Scott. Give Scott some advice on how to be one of the 100 coolest people.
Well, really, here's a funny story. I had not known that I was picked on that. And I jumped in my car and I was going down the street, and I had the radio on, and I hear this thing. Buzz Magazine picks the 100 coolest people in Los Angeles. Can you believe it? They picked this old has-been saxophone player by the name of Scott Cage to be the coolest guy. I will never forget that because I had no idea. It's kind of funny to me, but you know, again, I love people. I like to hang out. I've been fortunate enough to have taken been lucky enough in my life to have taken a pretty heavy spiritual path, not a religious path, but a spiritual kind of looking inward and right. kind of seeing what that's about. So from that, it's really made me realize that everybody does the best they can. We just got to live in a constant state of forgiveness. Everything is cool. I love people. I hang out like people. I tell them, hey, connect with me on Facebook. I'll talk to you. I don't care. I hang out with people. I do everything. So I think part of that was, if you want to be cool, just be kind. Be kind and understanding.
All right,
and
that's one thing I got to work on. I got to work on that net.
Kindness thing, right? Because that's really the key, right? It's so funny to me because we're seeing such an insanity right now the human condition, this whole thing. And you know what's so sad is I don't think people realize what's happening. I mean, really, the social media, the networks, the media is controlling people now at a level that it's incredible. Because here's the fundamental fact. The mind is incapable of knowing truth from falsehood. It can't determine whether something's right or wrong, because an easy way to prove that, if the mind was capable of knowing truth from falsehood, right from wrong, there would be no war. Mm-hmm. Nobody would blow up their kid in the name of some religious thing, because the mind can be controlled. It's really that voice, the watcher, that person that says, you know, don't do that. What is that thing that... basically that consciousness that makes you realize, you know, that's a bad idea or that's a good idea. It's that discerning. So what's happening is we're seeing just such a massive change in society with the fact that when you're watching this dang cell phone or whatever all day long, and those impressions that are impressionating, and you know, you're getting fed, the algorithms are feeding you what you want to hear and what you want to see and all this stuff. And so now we're getting completely controlled. What I will tell everybody on here, if you have not seen, you go to Netflix tonight, and I'm telling both of you, have you seen Social Dilemma yet?
I did. I watched it last week, actually.
All right. Yeah. Social Dilemma is important to see because it makes you realize what is actually going on. Now, as a technologist, we knew that, but this is a really good example of how they control. You can basically kind of shape people. This started a lot back in the days of, I don't know, have you ever heard of Edward Bernays?
No.
Okay, so Edward Bernays is basically the father of PR. He changed the word propaganda to public relations. And it was, I can't remember, it was back in the day, and his nephew was Sigmund Freud. Together, they created ways to control crowds. There's an incredible documentary. I'll tell you all to go watch. It's beautifully done. It's very compelling. As you soon as start watching it, it's called Century of the Self. Century, that's a BBC documentary. You can just Google it. Go watch that. And then take that, what you learned from that, and then go think of the internet and think of Social Dilemma, and you see what is exactly going on, how we're being kind of manipulated and controlled. So we have to be careful. We have to become more awake. Yeah. And what I mean, not woke, that's a different ball. That's not the same thing, because if you were woke, the minute you say something horrible about somebody, it tells you that you are asleep.
Yes.
Anybody knows any form of hate. I'm just so sad to see this sort of hate in the name of love thing going on. I'm hating somebody so much because I'm so loving and I'm so caring, when they don't realize hate is hate. We have to live in a state of forgiveness. We have to understand everybody does the best they can. They get up every day to do the best they can. And we're just human beings in the human condition. So
I agree, man. Know,
go watch those movies, everybody. Very important stuff.
I agree. Scott, we're coming up on our time here in just a minute.
Okay, beautiful.
I could talk to you for hours. We'd love to have you back on in the future. I got a million
man. I love talking.
Million more things I'd love to ask you. But if people want to go check you out or go check out all the things you're up to, what's the best place for them to go check you out?
All my social media is IAMScottPage. IAMScottPage. Awesome. So it's very simple. So you can just type that in. If you want to find out about a Think Experience, just think just Google Think EXP, and then you can see our dome shows. We've been doing these shows in this 360-degree immersive dome. Incredible, cool stuff. And cool. You'll kind of learn about what us and yeah, definitely check us out. Think X is my band, which is Stephen Perkins from Jane's Addiction and Norwood Fisher from Fishbone and Kenny Olds from Kid Rock Band. And we have this great band. And so we're out there. So check out Think X. Think out, check us out.
All right, Mike Scott Page. Think they'll ever do like a, maybe he'll do like a 3D, you know, 3D all-inclusive show of like where people could just join us in the podcast room?
No.
Okay. He was a good guest.
You wanted more details?
No, no. I don't expect
it. No, nobody would want it. There you go.
No, but really, really, really awesome guest there. So I guess we would be, I don't know. I guess it would be remiss if we didn't talk about the 2020 election. Now, let's preface this. Let's preface this because what we're saying today might be very different on the Monday when this episode comes out. So we are we are recording on Thursday, November, what's today, the 5th? November. November 5th. So by Monday where we put out our episodes, this could have a totally different angle. So I don't want to hear if we're all over the place here.
For your latest news from 5 days ago, come the Verbal Shenanigans.
So clearly it's been an interesting election here. It looked like Tuesday night Trump was once again gonna take it down, which I this entire time have said that Donald Trump is going to win. I thought it from the beginning. I just thought, you know, his followers, supporters are just so loyal and rabid, and you know, you see these rallies, it's hard to picture that he doesn't have, you know, everywhere he goes he's got whatever tens of thousands of people coming out to see him, and you see these people, and what was it, did they say like a 96 mile caravan or something of Trump supporters in Arizona or something like that, like of just cars, like it's incredible the support the guy has. Whether your views on him, hate him, love him, can't stand him, like him, it's pretty insane. Whatever he's awoke in certain people, you may never see again. You may see it every election from now on, but it's never been like this before.
I can't fathom a situation. I mean, some people will try to say Obama, but Obama was just more like people were making like posters and putting on T-shirts. I wouldn't call the fan base ravenous for lack of a better term, is in like everything he did. Everybody's like, we got to go there. I mean, yeah, he's got a huge base. I mean, it's, and they're well supportive, and I'll give him credit. I went into this same Biden all the way. Yeah. I was leaning kind of towards the, okay, the blue wave is going to happen.
Right.
Senate, House, President, whatever. And then a part of it was my stupidity. Like, I'm listening to the pollsters and like some people say, well, you saw with 2016. I'm like, yeah, but you know, I read up and they say, you know, they adjusted for certain things on like education levels and items like that. I've said, okay, they can't be that off.
Right.
Two times in a row. And I think we're kind of proven right now that I don't think we'll ever have a clean, like, poll going into any election from here on now, because it just boils down to whether it's a strategy or don't trust giving your answer. People are not literally just saying to these people, yeah, I'm going out there for Trump. It just seems like I said, I don't know if like deep down they're saying, if we don't say it and they get confident, they won't come out and we'll take it again. But it seems very clear, like, whether it's Trump itself or Republicans itself, they're holding on to the answer a little tight to the vest.
Yeah. And so, you know, we knew that if Donald Trump was to lose, he already, like, you know, he essentially built in his excuses, right? It was the mail-in ballots, the fraud. He was tweeting about it for months now. He was, you know, he had a a succession plan to combat this. We already know there's probably no chance of him transferring power peacefully. Like, you know, he's a giant baby when it comes down to it. A sore, you know, sore loser in everything. Like
the boy that we got from the United Kingdom.
Yes. I mean, we know this. I mean, I find it, even if you're a Trump supporter, like, you got to admit this guy does not lose well or take criticism well. That would not be in his characteristics that I would say he's very good at. But let's put it that way. So
he's great at everything. So there's a conundrum here.
Yeah. So yesterday morning, we wake up and all of a sudden we start seeing numbers in Michigan flying, numbers in Arizona coming up, numbers in Nevada, all these numbers popping up out of nowhere. And all of a sudden the election becomes an election, a contest that is super tight. And as the day goes on a little bit more, you start to see Biden pulling ahead. And right away, you check social media, see what people are thinking, and you know, your blue friends are going nuts. Your red friends immediately. Conspiracy this, conspiracy that, fraud this. We start seeing count the vote in some places. Don't count the vote in other places. It's like, guys, where are we on this? Like, so let me get this straight. If Trump won, all the mail-in ballots for him and everything were fine, right? There was no fraud, yeah. No fraud at all. If he lost, they're all fake. They're all...
Yeah.
So the mail-in ballots are only for Democrats, and that in Philadelphia they're supposed to keep counting. And what is it, Arizona? They were stopping, or one of them, Michigan. They wanted them to stop the count. It's just all over the map. It's just a sign of this generation. Like, you can't. No one can ever lose. It's just an excuse. It's always an excuse. You cheated. You cheated. No one trusts anything anymore. Let me grill the other side a little bit, because if the Democrats were losing, we know sure as hell cities were going to burn again. There's going to be riots and there's going to be looting and things on fire in Portland and in New York and all these places. You know damn well that was going to happen too. So I'm not getting Democrats off the hook either.
Yeah, I mean, the election night, basically, I came off of vacation, which we'll talk about next week.
Right.
Like, that night, we decided, I basically cleaned up some stuff, brought the tree down from the attic. I put up the Christmas tree, decorated it up. We sat in the living room, watched the new episode of Mandalorian that was out already with our friend on the phone chatting about whatever. It was actually a very comforting, beautiful night without knowing a single ounce of information. As we were done with the night, my wife started to look at the phone and she started questioning, and I literally told her, stop, don't want to hear it. Stop, don't care either direction, don't want to hear it.
Right.
Because my wife has anxiety, and definitely this election has triggered the anxiety, if you will.
Okay.
So then the next day, like, she went to bed basically near tears and barely slept that night because she's like, okay, another 4 years. I woke up and I kind of figured see this coming, because again, what a shocker when you tell all your fan base mailing is bad. You can't be surprised when all the mail-in votes are pretty much not for you.
Right.
It's right. The bottom line.
Exactly.
So I've been watching closely. I mean, I live down here in Georgia. It's pretty tight here. We're still waiting on if a flip happens. As this moment happens, Trump is in the lead by 3,000 votes, with still a lot more in the...
Wow. Is that what it's down to, 3,000? God.
Yeah, now it's down to 3,000. We're still waiting on the big areas of the counties with Atlanta and circling around Atlanta, so it'll be tight. It's not necessarily a win or lose or whatever, but so be it. Like the biggest thing that's come out of this is the two Senate seats down here have to go to a runoff, it looks like.
Okay.
Because I don't know if it's like a U.S. rule or just like local state rules, but like if you win the Senate race and you don't have 50% of the vote by rule, it goes to a runoff, which
is that like a 50-yard is that like a 50-yard dash or a 40 time?
I don't know if this is like a regular thing. Like there's two Senate seats up here. Not to go all crazy, but like one is one where a guy retired. So there was like 15 people listed under the options, and basically the top two, Kelly Loeffler, the one I told you about, who owns the Atlanta women's basketball team down here, where her team hates her. She ended up in second. And then I forget the other gentleman's name. But basically, since there's so many people, they were at like 29%, 27%. So January, there's going to be another election. Those two fight it out for the spot. The other Senate seat was the guy who's the incumbent, the Republican, and his opponent. And it was, again, this goes to pollsters say this was going to be, you know, razor thin between the two. And now the entire time it's basically been the Republican was up at like 7-8% of the vote. But now as the mail-ins come in, his percentage has dipped down under 50. So by rule, they're going to have a runoff, which I don't know if that makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, because it was a two-person race anyway, but just because he didn't get 50%, he's got to try to beat him again, which I don't know.
Interesting.
So that's like an interesting thing right there, and it's big because that's the whole, if the Democrats get four seats, they flip the Senate. So
right. The whole thing is so funny. You know, 4 years ago, you know, Trump wins, and there was all this, you know, the Trump supporters saying, look, you got to, you know, your guy didn't win. Stop crying, snowflake. You got to support the guy. You know, if your party doesn't win, it's okay. There was all those memes about the crying liberals. And it's the exact same thing. Everybody's such a hypocrite. It's like, it's not even over yet when we're talking right now. It might be over now when you guys are listening. It might be over. But this thing isn't going to end anytime soon. As far, he's going to drag it out. It's going to keep going. But if he loses, like, it's the same thing. They're going to act the exact same way the liberals they made fun of acted.
Yeah.
Exactly same way.
They're going to act like 2000, where with the hanging Chad situation. It's like, look, this is what the Supreme Court said. They can't count the votes. He barely won, but he's our president. Now it's going to be the same thing, and they're going to be crying about that. So, some of these states I don't figure out. Like, Alaska still shows as not complete yet. Somebody explain why Alaska is not done.
Yeah.
I mean, we all know it's going to Trump. I mean, it's not even like a conspiracy theory or something like that. We can all sit here and put a bet down. We're all putting it on Trump. It makes no sense. Hell, when California closes at 9 p.m. their time at 9 p.m. in 2 seconds, every news anchor says, okay, went to the Democrats.
Yeah.
So
Nevada too seems to be just strange, like how it just, it's like stuck at one position, like you barely get any updates.
Well, what it boils down to is like there's no like structure on like when an election happens, you have to do this certain procedure to like count. Like for example, in Pennsylvania, the county with Pittsburgh, apparently Thursday was supposed to be a day off. So, today or Thursday was supposed to be a day off for them. So there's going to be no counting on that day. So that's why that's going to stay frozen for an entire 24-hour stretch, which like
you couldn't give them like 2 days off in 2 weeks, you know, an extra, you know, work one extra day. Here's some overtime.
Yeah. I mean, I don't get it. I mean, what it boils down to, it's like I said, going into this election, whatever you think about the results or whatever, there's nothing uniform about our election procedure. It's very odd. We have two states where it's broken up, where you know, you win the state, but you have to win like the different divisions, like Maine and Nebraska. You have every state has a different voting kind of equipment. There's people, there's still punch cards. There's write-ins. It makes no sense that we're just like, this is the way it is, and let's make it easy.
Listen, I mean, you could apply for a mortgage online, right? And do all this amazing paperwork and verify your identity. And how are we not at a point? Your kids could go to virtual school now. How are we not at a point where you could vote from home and just do it on the computer? How are we not there? Give me 100 security questions that you got to answer to clear me, you know?
I mean, there should be a way, but I mean, every older person goes by, oh, some hacker could come in and do this and that, mainly because some hacker got into Trump's Twitter a couple weeks ago and they got into the Trump2020.com and changed the front page on that. But
I had an interesting thought. I think, you know, say Trump loses, Trump might be more dangerous, not as president, as far as with his supporters, because if he's no longer president, right, just think about what he can now tweet and what he can now, if this is the reined in presidential Trump right now, like is he following any kind of rules and things like, you know, muzzling himself on anything he wants to say? Think about the Trump off his leash, off a loss on Twitter and everything else with his supporters. He's going to be a nut job, you know, and his supporters aren't going away. And it's funny. Everybody says, like, we need someone to unite the country. No one can do that anymore because everyone's so polar left or right that there's no such thing. No one. Biden, initially, if he wins, is going to go in. Half the country hates him. Will never listen to him for 4 years and will love whoever they put next. It doesn't matter what he does. No one wants to support the other side at all. In anything, it doesn't matter what it is.
Well, that's why I can't even remember the last time I voted for like Republican or Democrat for president before this one. I'll try to stay neutral. I give every side credit. We've had Trump supporter. We had Elizabeth Pithko, who worked on the Trump campaign, I know, in the 2016 election.
Yeah.
We've had John Schneider on here, who did a music video called Trump Card.
There you go.
Yeah, and a side note on that, his video, and there's also like a NASCAR driver who sponsored by like one of the packs for Trump Pence, and he did like a music video. It was like a rap. And no offense to the Trump fans, if you like what you want, so be it, but those two both got to work on their stuff because it was very generic, both of that stuff. I don't sit back and tell you, you got to think this way, but I will literally say to John Schneider and the NASCAR truck driver rap, that was very minimalist, had no real range there. Got to work on that stuff. But anyway,
yeah.
I've always said we need 3-4 parties into these elections, like serious, like in debates, chatting about stuff, because I think there is a ton more. The only way to unify people is to kind of get in the middle. And I think like some people could get in if they have like some kind of party in that range where it's like, well, I'm a moderate lean red or moderate lean blue. It can excite a base or like gain stuff or whatever. I will say going into this, I could see a third party being built off of this election, but the Republicans should be scared because I can see Trump just saying, that's it, I'm my own party.
I can see it too. That's a good point.
And grabbing the base. The way his fan base is, I don't think he really sits back and worries about a moderate Republican. I think he only cares about the people who go out in 20-degree weather to cheer him on and don't mind they were stranded in the middle of Nebraska for eight hours.
I have always firmly believed he doesn't believe half the stuff he says. He just says whatever wins over the room. He just loves being loved. So if he can get love from the KKK, hey, it's love. If he can get love from the veterans, hey, it's love. It doesn't matter to him. Like, I really don't think it is. But
it's more about libertarian, I've always kind of said, and all. Then I mean, libertarian, their whole view is just kind of do whatever. We really don't care. We're not, government should just be sitting back relaxing.
Right. Yeah. So I think when it comes down to it, we got a few more days, a few more days, maybe a week or two till we figure out what's going on. And then we probably got a few years till we see the end of this, and then it'll be the next election.
Yeah, and we'll have bitching for the next 4 years, and yeah, life will continue on in misery. Sounds good.
Yeah, I just, the hypocritical support is so funny to me. I think that's the funniest part to me, like watching people do one thing and then literally doing the exact thing they make fun of people for over and over again. Like, listen, I am not a big Joe Biden guy, okay, but I know that Trump is not the answer for the future of this country, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, the way I will put it is, like I said, I feel myself as independent, probably lean a little more blue than red, but I don't go straight blue for anything. Trump pulls this off, this election, I won't be happy with it, but I'm not going to sit back and like, oh, my life's over kind of stuff. It will continue on. It will be just another day where you wake up and somebody comes up to you. Did you hear what the president says? And you went,
So if Trump wins, you're not going to drive to Atlanta and go burn a Turner building down?
No, it's by the sports stadium, so I need sports when this is all done. I mean, I still got tickets to the Atlanta Hawks that they got to redeem for me. In all seriousness, like when they shut down the NBA, the next day was supposed to be the NBA game was supposed to go to. I'm like, you know, good.
I'm sorry, Mike. You know, some people lost their grandparents. Some people lost their husband and wife. You lost your Atlanta Hawk tickets.
Scott, have you watched Trey Young play? Thank you.
I'd sacrifice my grandma for Trey Young.
I could have saw Vince Carter before he retired, but no. Thank you, COVID.
All right, let's get out of here. I'm sure we'll have plenty more to unpack on this. I said unpack. I hate when I say that. Plenty more to talk about with this whole election crap, and I'm sure that everyone's heard it from a million different places. So today we covered birth. We covered first-time parenting. We covered Pink Floyd saxophonist, and we covered the 2020 election. Just another week here on Verbal Shenanigans. Berlew, anything to promote?
Next week we'll talk about detergents.
Yeah. The big detergent cast coming up, that's for sure. Anything to promote before you go?
Yeah, I'll promote a good friend of ours, William Pierce. He's the one I've been working with doing Zoom workouts. He's really helped me out, lose a lot of weight, build some muscle and all that. He has a Facebook page. It's Lose Weight Now, New Jersey, where you can get a hold of him and you can work with him on possibly signing up for his virtual workout sessions. Like I said, they're half an hour long. He has them between 7 and 9 a.m. Monday through Saturday. He also has evening ones. I take the 6 o'clock one. I literally do my workout, rinse off, come down to do the podcast on Thursday.
Thanks for rinsing off for us, pal. Thanks for rinsing off for the show. That's a real commitment,
for you, buddy boy.
Real commitment.
I mean, I didn't. Next week we'll play the guessing game. Where did Berlew not rinse? But I digress. But
Berlew, we had zero downloads this week.
Well, the contest will keep going until somebody guesses, Scott. But on Facebook, look under Lose Weight Now New Jersey. You don't have to be in New Jersey for his virtual workouts, but he also works out in gyms and does training. Great guy, William Pierce. Again, it's on Facebook, Lose Weight Now New Jersey.
Okay, I will promote two people in New Jersey here. They are the most avid supporters of comedy. They show up to Tierney shows and Scotty shows and all sorts of local shows, and I'm pretty sure when comedy is going and there's no pandemic, they're at comedy shows three nights a week. They're unique people. They're very supportive. They've supported Verbal Shenanigans, things we posted online, and guests and whatnot. So Nancy and Bill Aronson, they have a store called Iggy's Curiosity Shop. And this shop is like full of like all sorts of unique collections over the years. Apparently they've been collecting for decades and it's kind of like their passion. And they've been very supportive of this comedy community. So it is in Midland Park, New Jersey. And you get the 11 Patterson Avenue, Midland Park, New Jersey. If you're into like unique things and little antiques and weird things to get for your office or your house or things like that, it's a great tiny little place to go. And it's a little small business. So go support them. That's Iggy's Curiosity Shop. That's it, guys. I want to thank Scott Page for coming on. The best thing you can do for us is go like the show, go follow us on social media, and spread the show to your friends, to your family, to your loved ones. Play it to your babies as they fall asleep. It'll instantly put them to sleep. That's it, guys. Life is funny. Laugh at it, and keep the wind at your back.
Kanye 2024.
Enough.